Thank you. My name is John Sylvester, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank you all for asking me to come over here from Palo Alto. I'm always honored to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to tell you something I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has not only saved my life, but it's made the life that it saved worth living. And when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, my drinking had taken me to a place in my life where I no longer believed that it was worth living. You know, I'm going to tell you, by the way, that I love this little motto of your Unity Day today, to laugh is to live. Jeez, you know, one of the first things that attracted me about Alcoholics Anonymous when I started going to meetings, when I first came to this program, was the laughter that I heard in meetings. There wasn't much laughter left in my life when I came to the program, and so I think this is a wonderful motto for today's Unity Day. I had my last drink, up until now at least, on December 28th of 1978, and so a couple of weeks ago I celebrated 25 years of sobriety, and thank you. Well, I'm delighted that you applauded that, because you should. Not because I deserve it, but because you deserve it. You see, if it weren't for you and people like you, I wouldn't be celebrating 25 years of sobriety now. My sobriety has everything to do with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a little bit to do with me, and I'm very grateful to be sober today. You know, I had to laugh. I was sitting and talking to some new friends, and I saw Maria walk in, and I thought, I recognize that woman, and Maria now lives in Modesto, and I walked over to her a few minutes ago, just before I came up here, and I said, didn't you used to live in Redwood City? And she said, no, I lived in San Carlos. Maria chaired a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Palo Alto, California, in early 1979, when I was in my very early sobriety, and you know, it's funny how you can be clear enough about stuff when you're sober to remember something from that far back, and it's a delight to see her, and it's just wonderful to be here. You know, if you hang around the program of Alcoholics Anonymous long enough and you hear yahoos like me get up and spout out, you get the impression that some people never had any fun drinking. I had a wonderful time drinking. Jesus, I just loved it. I have to tell you that not everybody else in my life had as much fun with my drinking as I did. But, you know, but I really did. I had a great time. I liked it from the beginning. I grew up in King City, over in the Salinas Valley. It's a town very much like Ripon, you know, a farming community and small town. When I lived there were maybe 2,800 people in King City. There were 25 bars. That seemed a proper number to me. That just, you know, from the beginning, I thought that was just about the way it should be. I knew I was going to drink before I ever did. You know, I would watch my parents have a drink and they'd lighten up a little bit. My dad wouldn't be quite as stern, and he was, by the way, an alcoholic, and ultimately shot himself to death with a 20-gauge shotgun as a result of his alcoholism at the age of 59. But as a kid growing up, I thought that it seemed very attractive to drink, and I knew that I was going to drink as soon as I was old enough to do so, and I knew I was going to smoke, and I knew I was going to gamble, and I knew I was going to chase girls and women. I had no real idea what I wanted to do for a living. I didn't have very many serious intentions, but I sure wanted to screw around a lot. And you know, so that's what I kind of set out to do. I started drinking more or less regularly when I was 13 years old and a freshman in high school. Now, I had dabbled in it a little before that. You know, my brother and I, my older brother, I have a brother 4 years older than I am who is not an alcoholic. Very responsible guy. God. I am not a very responsible guy, but Pete was a very responsible guy, and we were the first altar boys at St. Mark's Episcopal Church in King City. And when I was about 9 years old and he was about 13, he'd wake me up early on Sunday morning and we'd go over there to serve Holy Communion at 7:30 on Sunday morning. And he and Father Hawley would go outside the sacristy before the communion started to smoke a cigarette, and I would be left alone in the sacristy with the sacramental wine. And I would reach over and pick up the cruet, and I'd take a little drink of the sacramental wine. You know, and I can still remember that kind of the warm feeling of it coming down inside my body, and my neck got a little bit looser, and I just felt, you know, and then I'd have another little hit on the bottle of sacramental wine, you know. And so that was the beginning of my morning drinking. And also, it was the beginning of my having some guilt feelings about my drinking, because I'd worry about it during the service. You know, I'd be thinking, I wonder if that wine was blessed. I wonder if it makes any difference if that wine was blessed. I wonder if I died right now, if I'd go to hell. Didn't bother me enough to not do it again next Sunday when I got there at 7:30 in the morning, you know, so that, you know, that I should have caught on to something just then. 13 years old, freshman in high school, you've all been there in a room much like this, high school gymnasium, school dance, girls on one side of the room, boys on the other side of the room. I'm standing there with my buddies, looking across the room at some girl that I'd like to ask to dance, and I think, I just can't do it. I can't make that walk across the room, because if I do, she'll probably say no, then I'm going to have to walk all the way back across the room while everybody laughs. And I just couldn't face that. And a buddy of mine came up to me one night at one of those dances, and he said, "Got a bottle of whiskey out in the pickup. Do you like a little drink?" I said, "I'd love a little drink." And we went out to his pickup, and I took a little hit on that whiskey bottle. And that same feeling that I got before 7:30 in the morning at St. Mark's Episcopal Church came over me once again, that sense of warmth as it came down inside my body. And something else happened that was just wonderful. I no longer gave a damn. You know, I had a little whiskey in me, and I thought, you know, I can go back in there. I can ask that girl to dance. She may say yes. She may say no. Who gives a good goddamn? If she says no, I can always go out and drink some more whiskey. You know, I could stop right now. That's the story of my drinking. She may say yes, she may say no, who gives a good goddamn? I can always drink some whiskey. I drank a lot of whiskey. Oh well, that's the story. You know, I suffered from the illusion all of my drinking career that other people would like to drink the way I like to drink if only they could. I recognized from the very beginning that there were some people who didn't drink at all, perhaps for religious reasons. And I have to tell you that I felt vaguely sorry for them. I wondered what they did for fun. You know? And I also recognized that there were some people who didn't handle their liquor very well and you know, couldn't drink very much. And I felt vaguely sorry for them too. I had a name that I called them. It was kind of a nice name. I called them candy asses. And I kind of looked down on them as well. You know, I never thought that there was anything unusual about the way I drank. I thought that most people would have drunk the way that I drank if they had been able to. Apparently, other people found something a little unusual in my drinking. When I still have a high school yearbook at home from when I was a junior in high school in 51, 52. 15, 16 years old. You know, when kids write in your high school yearbook things like, remember all the good times we had in Spanish 3? It's not what they wrote in my yearbook. They wrote things like, roses are red, violets are green. You hold more beer than a B-17. So, a buddy of mine wrote in that yearbook, dearest alcoholic Johnny, prophecy, John Sylvester, noted blackguard and drunkard, drank self to death at the age of 40. I became perilously close to fulfilling that prophecy. So apparently there were people in my life, even back in high school, who thought there was a little bit something unusual about my drinking. I graduated from high school in 1953, and I came up to Stockton to go to what was then the College of Pacific. I want to tell you a little story about that that kind of, I think, exemplifies how important alcohol was to me. I was 17 years old. I walked into a liquor store with a fraternity brother of mine who was over 21. And I picked out a bottle of whiskey and I took it up to the counter, and the guy that owned the liquor store looked at me and he said, you're not 21, are you? And I said, no, I'm not. He said, your father's buying this whiskey for you, isn't he? And I kind of laughed and I said, yes. And he said, how old are you anyway? And I told him I was 19. I told him I was 19 when I was 17, because I knew I was going to be in Stockton for 4 more years. And I figured that if he thought I was 19 when I was 17, that 2 years from now, when I'm 19, he'll think I'm 21 and he'll sell me whiskey. You know, it never entered my mind until I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that there was anything unusual about setting up a source of supply for alcohol 2 years in advance. But there is. My brother, the non-alcoholic, it had never entered his mind. I know that at least half of you are sitting here right now thinking, pretty slick. Why didn't I think of that? I'll tell you something else about that incident. This happened probably late 1953, early 1954. The name of the guy that owned the liquor store was Jimmy Greer. The name of the liquor store was the Pacific Liquor Store. Who but an alcoholic remembers the name of a guy and the name of a liquor store that he bought whiskey in 50 years ago? I have to tell you that if you asked me for the name of 3 of my college professors, I couldn't give them to you. But Jimmy Greer and the Pacific Liquor Store are embedded in my mind forever. I mean, that's just the way it is, huh? I mean, and in this room, I'm not unusual. Graduated from Pacific in January of 1958. In those days, you had to spend some time in the military. I spent 3 years as a Navy officer. I went back to OCS in Newport, Rhode Island, and I spent 3 years as a Navy officer, and I drank my way around the world. I mean, I spent a year in Japan. I never saw Mount Fujiyama. But if you want to know about the bars and the cat houses in Thieves Alley in Yokosuka, Japan, I'm the guy to ask about them. I mean, I just loved them, you know? And I went around the world doing that, and I came back. The last year I was in the Navy, I was at NAS Miramar outside of San Diego. That's where I met my first wife. That tells you, by the way, that I've had more than one. I met her at the officers' club at NAS Miramar at a happy hour, and I bird-dogged her from some pilot that she was going with. And she and I went together for that last year that I was in the Navy, and she never complained about my drinking. The only thing I ever remember her saying about my drinking during that year before we got married was one Friday night, we were at a happy hour, and she looked at me and she said, why do you always take your drink with you when you go to the men's room? I had frankly never noticed that I always took my drink with me when I went to the men's room, but I was on my way to the men's room when she asked, and I had it in my hand, and so I said, well, I said, you know, sometimes there's a line in front of the urinal, and a guy could get thirsty while he's standing there waiting to go to the bathroom. That wasn't the truth. The truth is that I never liked to leave a drink lying around unattended. There are only a couple of things that can happen to a drink if you leave it lying around unattended, and none of them are good. Bartender snatches it up, or a cocktail waitress snatches it up, or some other yahoo reaches across the table and picks it up and drinks it. I did that to other people's drinks. Why wouldn't I expect them to do it to mine? So, you know, when I had a drink in my hand, it stayed in my hand, and I drank it. And then I put the glass down, and I had another one. And I picked that in my hand, and it stayed in my hand until I drank it. So that was... Joanne and I got married right after I got out of the Navy on November 11th of 1961, Veterans Day. I have to be very careful of these major holidays. I do strange things on these holidays. We got married on November 11th of 1961. We moved up to San Francisco. I went to work for an insurance company. We lived in San Francisco for a better part of a year, and then we moved down to Burlingame, right across the street from Peninsula Hospital, Maria. And I'm going to tell you a little story about that marriage, which again I think typifies the way my drinking was progressing. We'd gone to bed one night. I made a little move on Joanne. She rejected me. Not something that I ever handled very well, I might add. Not only did she reject me, she wouldn't argue about it. She just went to sleep. Lay there, breathing evenly, while I lay there festering. I just couldn't handle this. For whatever reason, we had no whiskey in the house. I got up. I put my clothes on. I went downstairs. I got in the car. I drove to a shopping center. That shopping center, Maria, that's right on the border of Burlingame and Millbrae. There used to be a little bar in that shopping center that was called the Gutter. It was later they changed the name to the Putter because the city fathers of Burlingame didn't like the idea of a bar being called the Gutter. But when I went there, it was the Gutter. So I drove over to the Gutter. I had about three or four scotches. I thought this should do it. I drove home. I went upstairs. I got undressed. I went to bed. I looked over at Joni. I got back up. I put my clothes back on. I went downstairs. I got in the car. I drove back to the Gutter. I had about three or four more drinks. I turned around. I drove home. I went upstairs. I walked into the bedroom. I didn't even take my clothes off this time. She was still asleep. I went back downstairs. Drove back to the... I don't know what the folks at the Gutter thought was going on. I was just trying to get myself to a point that I could handle what I'm sure you will all agree was this outrageous behavior on her part. Again, it never entered my mind until I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that there was anything unusual about this behavior. It always seemed to me when I thought about this incident that I had behaved like anyone would have behaved. I mean, what the hell do you expect a guy to do when he's been rejected for sex? That's just an outrageous thing to do. And so a few months later, in April of 1963, Joanne divorced me. She moved back to San Diego. I have never seen her to this day. She doesn't call. She doesn't write. I don't know about you, but I think it's over. Well, perhaps not, but I kind of think it is. She actually, I heard, married some other guy, just trying to put the finality on it. So I moved up to San Francisco, continued to work for this insurance company. They transferred me at one point because they thought I was partying too much back to Stockton, as though I didn't know places to party in Stockton. Then they transferred me to Palo Alto, and I became the manager of this insurance company. That's when I discovered the bars along the El Camino Real in the peninsula area. You know, I was out having drinks one night with my non-alcoholic brother, and he looked at me and he said, "You know, Johnny, you spend so much time in the bars and the El Camino, you are indeed the Count of the El Camino." And he meant it as a criticism, and I took it as a compliment. I thought, wow, the Count of the El Camino. I wonder if people know. You know, I didn't come here too tightly wrapped. About that time, an old friend of mine from college who was living in Palo Alto introduced me to the woman who was to become my second wife, and Barbara and I went together for about a year, and we got married on Cinco de Mayo of 1967. Huh? You know, these big holidays, I just have to be very, very careful. And that marriage lasted for almost 8 years. We got divorced in 1975, and we got married. You know, I had taken her to lunch one day, had about 5 or 6 martinis, bought her a bunch of drinks, and we got drunk and eloped. I mean, that's what happened. We got drunk and eloped and drove up to Reno and got there too late and ended up getting married in Carson City. My brother wouldn't come with me. He said, you know, I'm tired of watching you do this kind of stuff. But anyway, we got married, and actually the marriage was pretty good for a while. We had 2 children. We had a daughter, Jennifer, who's now 34, and a son, Peter, who's now 31. And you know, I thought that I had met somebody who wanted to party with me for the rest of my life. And the truth is that she wanted to get serious. She wanted to have these children and buy a house and lead kind of a structured life. And you know, that just wasn't what I had in mind. I didn't think I was very good at that. What I knew I was good at was screwing around. And I just didn't have the guts to tell her that. So, you know, the more I felt the pressure, the more I drank. The more I drank, the more it irritated her. The more it irritated her, the more she complained. The more she complained, the more I drank. And it just kind of went around like that as the years of our marriage moved on. Finally, in early 1974, one of her sisters came to me and said, you know what would really make Barbara happy? And I said, no, what? Believe me, I'd like to know. Why don't you buy her a new car? So I bought her a new car. And I thought, as long as I'm getting a new car for her, I should have one too. So I leased a new car for myself. Now, I don't know whether any of you have ever experienced anything like this or not, but I was always trying to find to rat hole money to drink with that my wife wouldn't know about. And so one of the things that I decided that I would do to kind of hide some money from her was to not buy automobile insurance on those cars, despite the fact that that's what I do for a living. That turned out to be a grave tactical error on my part. In August of 1974, I went to lunch one day at a place called Charlie Brown's up near the San Francisco airport. They used to serve something that they called a foot of martinis. A foot of martinis was a wine carafe filled with martinis. I had a couple of feet of martinis at lunch. I had a little wine with lunch. I had a couple of drambuies after lunch. I decided that nobody but a fool would drink drambuie all afternoon, so I switched to scotch. My buddies and I sat there talking about the 49ers. You know the kind of stuff you do. I mean, talking about the 49ers and ruining the reputations of women we had never slept with. That's the kind of thing that we talked about. You know, what the hell, we've all been there. You know, if you ladies don't know that, I'm telling you that now. That's what we did. And so, you know, about 4 o'clock, these other guys decided it was time to go home to their wives. I ran into another group of friends for happy hour. I stayed, I had dinner, had a little wine with dinner, had a couple of drambuies after dinner, called my wife at some point and said that I was having a meeting with a client and I wouldn't be home until late. At about midnight, I left this kind of complex of bars and restaurants, and a buddy of mine walked me to my car and he said, are you okay to drive? And I said, sure. Sure. I've only been drinking for 12 hours. I've probably only had 35 or 40 drinks. Anybody should be able to drive after that. Truth is that I was too drunk to know the difference. So I got in my car and I headed down to Mountain View where we lived. I made it almost all the way to the San Antonio Road turnoff, which was the turnoff that I would take off 101. I rolled that car on its top, was hanging upside down in the seatbelt. Some guy came and he knocked on the window, and I kept rolling the window up instead of down because I was upside down and I was discombobulated, you know. Finally, I got the window open, and this guy stuck his head in, and he said, "Are you all right, sir?" And I said, "Yes, but I can't get out of the seatbelt." And he punched the button, and I fell on my head. You know, it's just, it's an ugly scene. And I crawled out of the car, and I stood up, and I looked at the car, and Jesus, I am really in trouble. And then I heard the sirens, and I thought, Jesus, I'm really in trouble. So the highway patrol came, and I showed him my driver's license, and the highway patrolman said, "Have you been drinking, Mr. Sylvester?" And I said, "Yes, I did have a couple of glasses of wine with dinner, but that was several hours ago." He said, "Would you mind performing a few little tests?" And I said, "I'd be more than happy to." I had, by the way, performed these tests before. This was not the first time that I had been stopped for drunk driving, but I'd always managed to kind of skate my way through it. I felt that I was really pretty good at handling these tests, and I thought I was doing a reasonably good job once again until they came to a test that I had never had before, which was, would you put your right hand behind your back? Would you put your left hand behind your back? And then I was put in the back seat of the car. You know, one of the things that I remember about that incident is that I was sitting in the back seat of the car handcuffed, with my hands cuffed behind my back, and I said, "Could I have a cigarette?" I mean, and they said, "No, you can wait till you get to jail." And I thought, how unreasonable. You know, Jesus Christ, at least they could let me have a cigarette. So they took me to the Redwood City Jail. I called my wife. She had my attorney come and bail me out. He drove me home. We stopped and looked at my six-month-old Toyota in the wrecking yard on the way home, which didn't brighten my day, I have to tell you. We got home. Barbara is sitting in the kitchen in kind of a chenille bathrobe with a glare on her face, and I walked in, and she said, "Where are we going to find the $100 deductible?" I didn't have the heart to tell her that that was the least of our problems. So I said what I always said in those kind of circumstances. I said, "Don't worry about it. I'll take care of it." Went to bed. I want to jump ahead for a minute. You know, the second step of the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous says that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. When I first saw that, my problem wasn't so much with the concept of a higher power, it was more with the concept of sanity. I thought, true, I drank a little too much, but what's this sanity business? I mean, I'm not insane. Well, I want to give you a little example of my insanity. I went to bed that night. I got up the next morning. I showered. Barbara looked at me and she said, "What are you going to do today?" I said, "The Hartford Insurance Company is having a cocktail party on a red and white fleet boat in San Francisco today, and I'm expected there. I probably should go." She said, "How are you going to get there? You wrecked your car last night." I said, "I'll take yours." And I did. I got in her car, and I drove to San Francisco, and I went out on that red and white fleet boat. Several of the people who were there were the people that I'd been drinking with the day before. I drank all afternoon. I got in her car and drove right down 101 again. I mean, you know, I have to tell you that viewed from the perspective of a few years of sobriety, that strikes me as being reasonably insane behavior. So at the end of 1974, Barbara kicked me out of the house, and I moved in with my brother once again, which is where I go when women divorce me. My brother, I might add, is none too anxious to see me marry again. So I lived with him for about 3 months, and then I got a place on my own. I got another drunk driving ticket in early 1975. As a result of that, I ended up going to drunk driving school. I am a pioneer in drunk driving school. I went to drunk driving school in Santa Clara County in 1976 when it was a pilot program. All of you who have been to drunk driving schools since have me to thank for the fact that the thing is still going on. And you know, I was on probation. I wasn't supposed to drink. I certainly wasn't supposed to drink before I went to drunk driving school on Friday nights. But what I did was I said I won't drink after lunch on Fridays. My drinking just increased as I was living on my own. I started drinking in the morning. I started missing work. You know, I was a daily drinker who went on binges from time to time. Early in my drinking career, the binges didn't last very long and they were spread far apart. The closer I came to the end of my drinking career, the longer the binges lasted and the closer they came together until finally they were kind of indistinguishable from one another. One of the things that I did during the last several years of my drinking was to go on the wagon for 30 days every January. I'm sure some of you have thought of that. Surely if I can go for 30 days without drinking, I'm not an alcoholic. All I did was prove that I am an alcoholic. People who are not alcoholic do not have to go around going on the wagon for 30 days every year to prove it. My brother never goes on the wagon for 30 days. If he did, no one would notice. When I went on the wagon for 30 days, everybody noticed. If they didn't, I made sure they did. My partners would talk about how much it used to irritate the hell out of me. Boy, we look forward to January when you're not drinking. You show up on time every day. You do good work. I mean, it was just incredible. My partners used to have these meetings early in the morning, about once a week for the last year or two of my drinking, at which the subject of discussion was, what are we going to do about John? I was there. That was the worst part of it. They wouldn't, you know, if they'd had these meetings and I wasn't there, it would have been okay. But I got to kind of sit. It was like watching a tennis match, and they'd back these ideas back and forth. They never, by the way, asked me for any input. I thought that it would have been more civilized if we'd had these discussions over lunch, perhaps had a drink or two to kind of loosen our tongues to get some really good ideas flowing, you know? 1978, early 1978, I not only stayed on the wagon for January, I stayed on the wagon for February. March came around, I thought, you know, I had the idea that I might not drink in 1978, but I knew I couldn't commit to not drinking for a year. I had the idea that I might do it a month at a time. Not quite the idea that we have, but I was moving in the right direction, you know, and so March came along, and I was not going to drink in March, and sometime in the middle of March, I was up in Menlo Park visiting my children and their mother, Saturday morning, about 11 o'clock, and I happened to comment to Barbara, to my kid's mother, that I was thinking about buying a condominium, and she said, "It must be nice." That was more than I could handle. As you can imagine, I mean, what an insulting thing to say. It must be nice. I left and I drove to Henry's in downtown Palo Alto. I walked in, sat at the bar, ordered a Dewar's White Label on the rocks. The bartender said, "Oh, you're drinking again?" I said, "Yes, I certainly am." And I pretty much didn't draw a sober breath for the rest of 1978. I don't mean that I was always falling down, stumbling drunk. I wasn't. But I rather doubt that for the rest of the year that I was ever legally sober. I just, you know, I binged and I missed work and then I'd show up at work. And in August of 1978, I got another drunk driving ticket. This was the third. I almost got two that night because when the bail bondsman bailed me out of jail, I had him take me to my car and the same cop pulled me over again and he said, "You're still drunk?" I begged him to just take me home. I mean, I knew that I was in big trouble. So, October of 1978, One of my partners and I had gone down to Carmel, to Pebble Beach, to some swell affair that some insurance company we did business with put on. I was very, very careful of the way I drank during this, you know, because I knew Tom was watching me. And on Friday morning, we were driving back to Palo Alto. He was driving. He looked over at me and he said, "John, I hate to do this, but we're going to have to talk about your drinking again." Well, if he hated to do it, you can imagine how I felt. I said, "What seems to be the problem?" He said, "On the days that you bother to show up at work, you look so terrible and you smell so bad that you frighten the women who work here." Not the kind of thing a guy likes to hear on a Friday morning as he's looking forward to a pleasant weekend. He said to me, "I know you can't stop drinking. Could you just not drink during the week?" I said, "Exactly what do you mean by that?" As though this were somehow a difficult concept to grasp. But I sensed that I was about to make kind of a monumental commitment, and I wanted to understand the parameters of that commitment exactly. He said, "From noon on Friday until Sunday night, you can drink as much as you want to. But starting on Monday morning and until noon on Friday, you don't drink at all. Can you do that?" Well, he kind of had me between a rock and a hard place, didn't he? You know, if I said, "No, Tom, I can't do that," he would have said, "I think you're an alcoholic, and I think you know to need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous." He had told me that before, by the way. My sister was already in Alcoholics Anonymous by this time. My brother and I had taken her down to Pacific Grove a couple of years before to a place called Beacon House because my sister, oh, should hear her story. She was an awful drunk and was in grave danger and needed our help very badly. And so I knew that that's what he would say. Furthermore, it was a Friday morning when he said this, and I said, "Sure, Tom, if it means so much to you, I'll be glad to do that." I said, "Just drop me off at my house." And he did, and I drank out the weekend. I went to work on Monday. I didn't drink on Monday. I didn't drink on Tuesday. I was sitting in my office on Wednesday, and I was kind of thinking about what was going on in my life. I was 42 years old. I was the executive vice president of this insurance firm. I, to outward appearances, seemed like a reasonably successful guy. I loved my children. I neglected them, but I loved them. I thought, you know, it's just not right. It's just not fair. A guy like me, if he wants to have a drink, should be able to have a drink. So what I'm going to do, and this was my one attempt in my drinking career at controlled drinking, what I'm going to do is that when workday is over about 5 o'clock, I'm going to drive home and I'm going to stop at a bar in Palo Alto. It was called The Winery. It was right near where I lived, and it was a good restaurant and a nice bar, and I thought, you know, I'll just stop in The Winery after work on the way home, and I'll have 3 or 9 drinks. And that's the way it rolled off in my head. You know, I was going to say 3 or 4. No, 3 or 4, 9. 9 drinks seemed to me like a reasonable amount for a guy to drink in the evening. You know, if you think about it, you'll agree with me. If you drink at the rate of 3 drinks an hour, which we'll all agree is reasonably slow drinking, if you have 9 drinks, you're only drinking for 3 hours. You get in there at 5 or 5:30. You're out of there by 8 or 8:30. Home and in bed by 9, maybe even have something to eat. Who knows? And get up the next morning fresh as a daisy. Just didn't work that way, did it? You know, because what happened is that after about 9 drinks, I was just getting that feeling like, God almighty, who'd want to go home now? You know, she might be here tonight. The fact that she hadn't been there for the last 25 years never entered my mind. She might be the night. Who knows? As one of my partners once said to me, even a blind pig finds an acorn once in a while. So I get home at about midnight or 1 o'clock, and I think, Christ, I got to sleep fast, you know, and I'm trying to hide it from my partners. Thanksgiving of 1978. My sister and her husband are living in Pacific Grove. They're firmly ensconced in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a phone call from my brother, the non-alcoholic, and he said, we're having Thanksgiving dinner at my house. Ann is coming up, and she's going to cook the turkey. Are you coming? He didn't say, are you coming? He said, are you coming? Truth is, I didn't want to come. I didn't want to come. I mean, I knew the way. They were going to watch my drinking, but I didn't see any way out of it, and I said, yeah, I'm coming. He said, well, why don't you bring a bottle of that good scotch that you like so much? So I brought a bottle of Glenlivet scotch over to my brother's house for Thanksgiving on 1978. He had one drink of it. I drank the rest of it, sat and played the piano. My sister was pouring me drinks. I later learned that my brother said, why are you pouring him drinks? And she said, we're trying to pour him into Alcoholics Anonymous. At dinner, they asked me to say grace. The grace lasted 45 minutes. They have never asked me to say grace to this day. I mean, to this day. I mean, I don't say it all that often, but when it happens, they don't ask me to say it. Boy, I'll tell you that. So, you know, I drank out that night, and I went home for the Thanksgiving weekend, and I never went back to work for the rest of the year. That wasn't my plan. That's just the kind of thing that happened. You know, I drank for that weekend. I got up on Monday morning, and I really felt awful. I had just a blinding hangover. I just couldn't face the thought of going into the office that morning. It was about 6:30 in the morning, 7 in the morning. I didn't have any liquor in the house because I had drunk it all. There's a bar near where I lived in Palo Alto. It used to be called Ethan's. It's called The Island now. It's one of those places where people go, Maria remembers it, where people go at 7 o'clock in the morning to have social drinks with their friends. And so I went into Ethan's, and I sat there, and I had a couple of scotches. And then I went home, and I called my office, and I said, I've got the flu. I won't be in today. If you call later in the day and I'm not here, I'm probably at the Palo Alto Medical Clinic. I went to sleep for a while. About 11 o'clock, I got up, I got dressed and showered. I drove to the winery, which was about 3 or 4 blocks from my house. And I stayed in the winery until about midnight. And I went home and I went to bed. And I got up the next morning and I drove to Ethan's. And I had 3 or 4 drinks with the other social drinkers there. And I went home and I called the office, and guess what I said to them? The flu hasn't gotten any better. I won't be coming in again today. If you call later and I'm not here, I'm probably at the Palo Alto Medical Clinic. I told them that every working day for the month of December. I mean, honest to God, I don't know whatever entered my mind to think that they were going to buy this kind of stuff. So, you know, so that's what I was doing. Even I had to recognize that my drinking was getting out of hand. I want to tell you how I felt in the month of December of 1978. There was one thing that was absolutely clear to me in the month of 1978, and that is that as bad as my life is today, all I have to look forward to is that tomorrow it's going to be just as bad or worse, and I don't think there's anything I can do about it. I don't know why I didn't think there was anything I could do about it. I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd actually been to a couple of meetings. I went to a meeting drunk with my sister and brother-in-law in Pacific Grove one night, and I am told that at the end of the meeting, I stood up and spoke. You can imagine how thrilled people were. I told them what a wonderful organization I thought they had. But, you know, so, and the other thing that was clear to me was that anyone who had any reason to count on me, my children, my former wives, my business partners, my brother, my sister, anyone who had any reason to count on me would be better off if I were dead. And so would I. But I just didn't have the guts to do anything about it. I was standing in the winery one day a little bit before Christmas in 1978, about 11:30 in the morning, a little before noon. Another local businessman walked in and he looked at me and he said, "I understand that you have been in here every day this month. What's the matter? Don't you work anymore?" And I looked at him and I said, "Listen, asshole, when you're really successful, you can afford to take the month of December off." And I knew the lie of what I was saying, and I knew that he knew the lie of what I was saying, and I had to say it anyway, didn't I? I had to say it anyway. That bravado, that "you can't get me," and I turned my back on him as though he were the loser, not me. December 28th of 1978, I was sitting in the winery. One of my partners came in. We talked for a while. He'd been looking for me all month. We talked for a while. He went back to the office. He called my sister in Pacific Grove, and he said, "If there's anything that can be done for this guy, you better do it now, because we can't put up with him anymore the way he is." I drank out that day. I went home that night. When I got up the next morning, for some reason I didn't go to Ethan's. I just sat there in this little rented house in Palo Alto, feeling sorry for myself, wondering what I was going to do next. I heard a car pull up in front of my house. I pulled back the drawn drapes and I looked out the window and I thought, "Christ, it's my sister. I wonder what she's doing here." And she and some other AA Yahoo got out of the car. They walked to the door. They knocked on the door. There was no place to go. I answered the door. I said, "What are you doing here?" My sister said, "I'm here on business, Johnny." I said, "What kind of business?" She said, "AA business." I said, "Who are you here to see?" It seemed like a reasonable question. She said, "I'm here to see you." I said, "Oh, well then come on in." She introduced me to this guy, Mike, that she had brought with her. Mike was a carpenter who was doing some, a contractor who was doing some remodeling on their house in Pacific Grove, and he was also an AA. I want to tell you something that he told me that day that I have never forgotten. He looked at me at one point in this process and he said, "I know the kind of drunk you are. You're just like me." He said, "When I was drinking, I was a carpenter. And after I got about 9 drinks in me, I became a contractor." I mean, isn't that what it did for you? That's what it did for me. It made me feel bigger than at some level I knew I really was, you know? At some point, I said to my sister, "What is it you want me to do?" She said, "I want you to get in the car and drive down with us to Pacific Grove and put yourself in Beacon House for a month." I said, "Ann, believe me, I'd love to, but I have a business to run." She said, "No, you don't. Your partners have told me to tell you that if you don't put yourself in Beacon House, they're going to find a way to kick you out of the business. Your ex-wife's not going to let you see your children anymore, and they're going to take away your Lincoln Continental." Now, who knows which of those three things on that particular day rang my bell the most, but in combination they were more than I could deal with, and so I agreed to go down to Beacon House. I called my partners and told them that I was going, and they wished me well. I called my ex-wife and told her that I was going, and she wished me well. I called my brother and told him I was going and borrowed the money to go to Beacon House. My brother, by the way, didn't just loan me the money. He paid it directly to Beacon House. He didn't pay a month in advance either. He paid it a week at a time. Had they been willing to accept it a day at a time, he might have tried that. But he, I don't know why, but Pete didn't have absolute confidence in my ability to kind of make it through this process. So we got in my sister's car, and we drove down to Pacific Grove listening to AA tapes all the way. Oh, God. Oh, God. If you can imagine listening to AA tapes with a kind of hangover that I had, some guy named Johnny A. from Southern California, who was a Danish building contractor, a wonderful speaker, but he cackled all the time during his talk. And I mean, Jesus, he would cackle and laugh, and my head would hurt, and I'd say, you know, I wouldn't listen to anything if she'd just shut it off. So we got down to Pacific Grove. She and her husband and I, Bob, went to dinner. We went to a meeting, a Friday night meeting in Carmel. My brother-in-law chaired the meeting. I was chairing a meeting somewhere, and they were there, and I was talking about that meeting, and I said, you know, I was at that meeting, and some asshole was chairing, and after the meeting was over, Bob said, I was the asshole, and, oh, okay. You know, I remember standing in the back of that room with one of those styrofoam coffee cups waving in my hand, thinking, this is it. The rest of my life with these assholes, but that's what it's come to. That's what it's come to. That's where I have been brought as a result of my actions. And after the meeting was over, people came up to me and they were introduced to me by my sister or my brother-in-law, and they would say things like, oh, we're so happy to see you. We've been waiting for you. Can you imagine what it makes you feel like to know that the folks at Alcoholics Anonymous have been waiting for you? I mean, didn't do a lot for my self-esteem. Then they took me to Beacon House, dropped me off. I went upstairs to a room and I went to bed. I got up the next morning because they said you had to be up at 7 in the morning, and I did it. I went downstairs and there was some woman there that was another inmate, and she said, what do you want for breakfast? And I said, I don't eat breakfast. And she said, you do here? And I said, well, okay. And you know, an incredible thing happened to me. The great miracle of my life, in my opinion, is that I found that I liked Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not come here expecting to like Alcoholics Anonymous, but I found from the beginning that I liked it. I liked you people. I liked your meetings. I liked the laughter that we talk about in the motto of this meeting. I liked the fact that I started feeling better, not just physically, but emotionally and spiritually. I liked the fact that some hope started creeping into my being that maybe this is the nature of my problem. Maybe I'm just an alcoholic, and if I just do the things that the people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous suggest, I might get better, and my life might get better. And you know, in its very simplest terms, that's just what's happened for slightly over 25 years now. As a result of doing some fairly simple things that you people have suggested, as a result of working the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, as a result of continuing to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, as a result of going to lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, as a result of not drinking between meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, as a result of getting and working with a sponsor, as a result of sponsoring other people and working with them, as a result of doing some fairly simple things that you people have suggested to me that I do, I have gotten better, and my life has gotten better. A remarkable thing happened to me in that 30 days that I was in Beacon House, and that is that I changed from a man who wanted to drink more than he wanted to do anything in the world to a man who wanted to not drink more than he wanted to do anything in the world. I had become convinced that any hope that I had of leading a reasonably competent, a reasonably serene, a reasonable life was based upon my ability to not drink a day at a time. For the first time in my life, I became willing to follow someone else's instructions. You know, I can still remember Big Gene, who is long since dead. The guy that ran Beacon House was a guy named Big Gene. He was a graduate of Folsom Prison. He looked at me about a day before I was ready to leave Beacon House, and he said, I've got some suggestions for you when you get back to Palo Alto. and he told me what to do when I got back to Palo Alto. He told me when I went into the office on that first Monday morning that after I had said hello to all the people that I worked with, that I should get out the phone book and get the phone number of the Central Office of Alcoholics Anonymous and call that number and ask where there was a meeting for me to go to in Palo Alto that night. And I did it. He told me that when I went to that meeting that I should get to that meeting 15 minutes early and introduce myself to the secretary and tell the secretary that I was new and that the secretary would see to it that I met some people. He said that after the meeting was over, I should help empty ashtrays, which we had in those days, and empty coffee cups, that I should come up and thank the secretary for putting on the meeting, and that I should thank the speaker for speaking, and that I should introduce myself to four people that I didn't know at every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I went to for the first 90 days. And he said, if you do those things, and you do those every day for 90 days, you'll stay sober long enough to start working the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is, after all, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, much to my surprise, I was willing to do that. I have to tell you that I know that I come across as a reasonably self-confident, gregarious guy. But I, you know, it is as hard for me to walk up to people and introduce myself as it is for anybody else. I honestly believe that if I walk up to somebody after this meeting and say, hi, my name's John, that your reaction is going to be, who gives a shit? I've got bigger fish to fry. I mean, you know, that's just the way we all feel. But I did it, and it allowed me to stay sober. I met a guy, a buddy, who's a buddy of mine to this day, when I was about a week back from Beacon House, who didn't have a driver's license. He was sober. He's sober today, about 2 months longer than I am. I thought he'd been sober forever. He asked me if I'd give him a ride to a meeting. We ended up going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous together every night for the first year we were sober. There were lots of nights when he didn't want to go to a meeting, but he knew I was going to be coming over to pick him up. There were lots of nights when I didn't want to go to a meeting, but I knew that he was expecting me to come over and pick him up. And so I would drive over and pick Gordon up, and we'd go to the meeting, and we'd laugh. People didn't think we understood the problem. Maybe we didn't. We'd walk in, and we'd laugh and carouse, and we had a hell of a time. When we were about 6 months sober, they made us the secretaries, the co-secretaries of the big speaker meeting in Palo Alto at that time, which was at St. Albert the Great, you know, and we just had a wonderful time running that meeting. And during that time, my kids were starting to spend the weekends with me again. And my daughter, Jennifer, was 9 and Peter was 6. And they'd sit in the front row while Gordon and I ran the meeting. And the people that became friends of mine who were in my sobriety class remain friends of mine to this day. And for anyone who's reasonably new to this program, I would like to suggest to you to make friends with people who are at about the same stage of sobriety as you are and help one another out, because God knows that I got a lot of help from the people that I got sober with, and some of them got some help from me. And I got a sponsor, and I started working the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was as a result of working the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that the changes in my life started occurring. You know, I am a different man today than I was 25 years ago when I was sitting in Beacon House. When I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you couldn't count on me for anything. You know, I was famous for not showing up at places where I said that I would be. Today, if I say that I'm going to be in Ripon, California to speak at a meeting at 10:30 on a Saturday morning, you can pretty much count on the fact that I'm going to be here. And that is a tribute not to me. That is a tribute to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If a drunk like me can get sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, anyone can. If a drunk like me can become reasonably responsible as a result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, anyone can. You know? I have been given a life in this program, as I said at the beginning, that is worth living. I cannot possibly I cannot possibly explain to you how grateful I am for this program. You know, when gratitude is the subject of a speaker discussion meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, if I am called on, what I will tell you, one of the things that I am most grateful for is that I haven't gotten what I deserved in life. Because if I'd gotten what I deserved in life, I wouldn't be standing up here talking to you today. I wouldn't be standing at all. You know, I've talked long enough. I've really loved being up here and being with you people today. I want to tell you one final small story, and then I'm going to sit down and let you get on with the rest of your day. You know, I told you about that time when I was 6 months sober and Gordon and I were secretaries of the meeting in Palo Alto. When after about the third of those Sunday mornings, my kids and I were driving back to my little rented house, and my son Peter looked over at me, 6 years old, and he looked over at me and he said, "Dad, you're still an alcoholic, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, Peter, I am." He said, "That's okay, because you don't drink anymore." I said, "That's right." He said, "It's a good thing you just get in trouble again." I thought, wow, here's a six-year-old kid. He's been to three meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He already knows everything I need to know. I'm still an alcoholic. It's okay because I don't drink anymore. It's a good thing I just get in trouble again. Thanks so much for listening.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com. We'll be right back.